This is Jeffrey Sachs, editor of Tradition, with another episode of the Tradition Podcast. In our recent winter 2021 issue, we published Jewish Sovereignty and the Redemption of the Shekhinah, an original essay by Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, who has proven quite prolific over these many years after his passing. It's a manuscript translated from Yiddish containing the Rav's speech to the Mizrahi Convention in June 1948, just a few weeks after the establishment of the State of Israel. For those of us who've been careful followers of his teachings on religious Zionism these many decades, it should go without saying this is a very significant and noteworthy text. In the new issue, we also published an article titled A Halachic Framework for Decision-Making in Acute Critical Illness by Judah Goldberg. Rabbi Dr. Goldberg, who practices emergency medicine at the Shaarei Tzedek Medical Center in Jerusalem and at the Memorial Hospital West in Pembroke, Florida, is on the teaching faculty of Michlelet Mevaseret Yerushalayim. In the essay, he explores the array of complicated decision-making in difficult, traumatic circumstances, including end-of-life decision-making, though not only. His framework will help guide the interactions between physicians, clergy, and the acutely ill patient and his or her family in what are always, even under the best cases, very complex circumstances. So, Judah, welcome to the Tradition Podcast. Tell us a little bit about what you're saying in this proposal and what you're suggesting for change.
Thank you, Jeff, for inviting me to this program to talk about this article. I would say if I could summarize the main takeaway of the article, it's that when facing difficult medical choices, particularly about invasive and aggressive interventions, patients should feel empowered in the name of halacha to make decisions that seem to be intuitive to them. Meaning, if an intervention seems to give them a good chance of meaningful recovery, absolutely. We believe in medicine, we believe in recovery, believe in trying to restore life, productive life. But if a patient is compromised and reaches a point where even the aggressive interventions that are suggested seem to simply not be in their best interests, the downsides, the possibility of outcomes worse than death, either prolonged death or dying process, or even persistent, prolonged, untreated suffering, then a patient should feel free in the name of halacha to decline that intervention.
And that the patient and or his or her family should really be the ones that are driving this decision.
Sure. Decision-making is never meant to be a burden to patients and or families. Sometimes it can be overwhelming. Sometimes it's something that they want to bring other voices into, whether it's rabbinic voices or other pastoral voices, or ask the medical professionals to give them more information. But patients and or their families, either together with their families or families in their place, if the patient's incapacitated, should feel that they can make decisions. What I found in my experiences is that sometimes patients or families have a sense of the trajectory that things are taking, how the patient has deteriorated over time, how even though there's no specific terminal diagnosis, they are unfortunately, I guess, if I use somewhat of a crude term that's sometimes used in medical context, they're circling the drain. Things are going southward. And patients have a sense that aggressive interventions can only cause more harm than good. Sometimes yet there is, I guess, a hesitation that halacha would want something else from them, that if they refuse that care or decline, that somehow they're betraying Torah, halacha, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, all three. And the point of the article is to argue from halachic sources that patients ought to be empowered to make the decisions that seem to be best for them.
So for those of us that are less up to date on the halachic literature or people that have blessedly not been initiated to the society of family members who've had to accompany loved ones at this point of life. How does what you're suggesting differ from the state of the issue up until now in the major trends in halachic writing?
Sure. So importantly, in my article, I try, might sound paradoxical, I try not to be mechadish anything. I try not to say anything on my own. And my arguments, I think, are built and therefore hopefully buttressed by the rulings of the giants of the late 20th century. Specifically, I have in mind of Moshe Feinstein, as well as of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. They established the precedent, and they were joined by several other figures as well, that in certain scenarios, it is okay to withhold care. That as much as we believe in the sanctity of life and the preciousness of every moment, in cases where life is too much of a burden, where there is incessant suffering involved, and where survival is really not an option, then care need not be pursued. I think the issue is that their rulings related specifically to patients who had terminal illnesses, patients who had irreversible disease, and where the only issue was, should there be attempt at prolonging life further, but the idea of actually reversing the process and restoring long-term life was not an option. The medical literature, the halachic literature, I should say, until now, has built upon their rulings, but I think in a more narrow sense of hewing closely to what they wrote about, which is exactly the situations of terminal illnesses. Only a patient, let's say a patient with end-stage cancer, a patient who's got severe advanced dementia, which really in the end stage, that's where the halachic literature has been most free in making use of their rulings. Mm-hmm. I try to address areas where simply the prognosis is unknown or it's uncertain. And I contend that these aren't the exceptional cases, this is the norm. That the terminal situations, they are the exceptions, but that much of what I see in the clinical context, both because of the nature of disease itself and the nature of the medical practice, medicine is a probabilistic undertaking where we try to make predictions. We talk about probabilities, but unless the probability is either 0 or 100%, we refrain from giving absolute pronouncements, or at least we ought to. We don't always keep to that principle. But in general, medicine is making predictions of probabilities and not giving absolute statements about what's going to happen.
Even though your patients very often are demanding such statements or expecting them.
That is true. That is true. It's we all want certainty. And it's hard to live with uncertainty. I think there's no time more than our current pandemic to reflect upon the difficulty of uncertainty. I think what I find as a doctor, it's not just, I think, genuine in terms of the way medical information and medical predictions are made. I think it's genuine to the way I experience it. The uncertainty is just more honest. I can look at a patient, I can say, your prognosis is poor. The chances of meaningful recovery are very low. Can I say with absolute certainty that any given treatment cannot help you? I can't say that, and I would never say that. And I think it's a disservice to overspeak. Patients who are looking for that certainty and want to bridge that gap from poor to non-existent, I'm not insistent that they focus upon it. Mm-hmm. But more often than not, I find that patients and families too, as much as they want certainty, they also deeply appreciate that honesty and they want to be able to make decisions out of an honest account.
Just rewinding for a second to an earlier point that you mentioned, we should just specify that this conversation has absolutely nothing to do with the topic of euthanasia. Your proposal and your framework is not discussing euthanasia, but other types of decision-making in acute critical illness.
That is correct, and I appreciate your clarifying that. Again, my entire argument is built out of the published rulings of major poskim, to the extent that these major poskim themselves did not speak, certainly not about active euthanasia. And as well, it happens to be these poskim had significant reservations about ever withdrawing care. I guess what colloquially might be known as pulling the plug, so to speak. So the only medical questions in mind are pursuing new treatments or initiating treatments, withholding care that has been suggested. But yes, you are correct. This decision, it's a worthy discussion in its own right, but this particular discussion does not relate to withdrawing care that's already in place.
Over the course of your medical career, both as a medical practitioner as well as a medical ethicist, which is a kind of other hat you wear in addition to your role as a teacher of Torah, well, your feelings and your thoughts on these topics have probably evolved. What you write here might not be something that you would have been likely to have thought or said as a younger physician. Can you tell us a little bit about the arc and evolution of how you came to these ideas?
That's a good observation. It is an interesting point. I think when I entered medical school, my wife Shana thinks that finds this amusing. I entered as the great protagonist of the sanctity of life and preserving every moment. And at the time, I found much of the talk about palliative care and making rational decisions to be intimidating, I would say, or threatening, and thought it was threatening to my Judaism. And I think that's actually something that's quite common, of a sense of antagonism between the field of palliative care and people who are devout to the religion, for both earned reasons and unearned reasons, that there's a sense of suspicion there. I think a few things happened along my pathway. I became more educated both in my medicine and in my exposure to halacha. In the medicine, I think I underestimated, until one's in the clinical context, how difficult the burden of chronic illness can be and how much suffering can be involved. Suffering, I'll just, if I can elaborate for our listeners, suffering, it's not a happy topic, but it's important to understand, and it comes in a lot of different flavors. Sometimes the suffering is because of the illness itself. Patients have been robbed of dignity because of cognitive dysfunction. Patients have a enormous pain from end-stage cancer. Sometimes the suffering is imposed by the medical care. Sometimes in obvious ways, let's say invasive surgery or painful procedures. Sometimes it's just even the routine of care. I can think of the patients who came in where they come into the emergency department. Our first job is to establish intravenous access, an IV, and to take some blood samples. And their veins have been so traumatized over the course of years that they become pincushions, unfortunately, of trying in the gentlest of ways and the most sensitive ways, but sticking them over and over, which itself can be agonizing. That's before we've even ever started care. And to be on a pathway of frequent admissions to the hospital, of more complicated and more complicated and harder just to establish, as I said, IV access, things like that, the burden of suffering really can be quite enormous. Mm-hmm. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, I think I became more educated as well about what the, I guess the nuance that our tradition speaks about. I like in particular, there's a letter that was written by Rav Yaakov Kanievsky, the Stipler Gaon, where he was asked, he said, the idea, the popular idea that in Judaism, one must do everything they can to prolong every moment of life. He writes something along the lines of, yes, I too heard this in my youth. And yet when I grew older, I began to question it. Now, what I find so fascinating about this letter is that this was written by the Stipler Gaon, who grew up in a small shtetl of Hornsteipel somewhere in Eastern Europe, probably without running water and without electricity, and certainly without any ventilators, without dialysis machines. Right. And I can't imagine what that statement meant in that time period. Right. And yet he said, as I grew older and I learned, I understood that the halachic situation is more complex. And I would say these two factors together, on the one hand, understanding that despite our deep commitment to preserving and prolonging life, the burden of suffering that is out there, and on the other hand, the nuance with which halacha relates to it, I think that my thinking has evolved over the years.
Well, speaking of the evolution of your thought, if we look back into the tradition archives, readers will discover another piece you authored for us in 2010, in our summer 2010 issue, an article about the ethics of truth-telling to patients. These two essays are, of course, interrelated, and I'm curious how you think they fit together and how the two pieces are in dialogue with each other.
That's an interesting question. Thank you for bringing that other article up. When I think about it, I think there's two points of overlap that are most significant to me in reflecting back on the two of them. One, I would say both of them were driven by a sense that the halachic literature was not describing the clinical context that was familiar to me. The way that the halachic discussions I was reading about truth-telling were speaking about it, the considerations involved, it just didn't match the clinical environment and the medical practice that was my daily life. And so too, in terms of relating to critical illness and the difficult decisions involved. And really I was driven by a desire to somehow not update a halacha, but update halacha's conceptualization of a situation. I would say halacha, like every legal system, has to conceptualize a scenario, has to look into itself to find the right terminology, the right description of what it sees before it. And I just thought that there was room to sharpen that and to refine that and to come up with a halachic description that the people on the front line, not just myself, hopefully other medical practitioners like me, would read that and say, yes, that describes me. That describes what I'm seeing. That is on the mark in terms of what I experience, irrespective of what the actual judgments involved are. That's point number one. I think the other point, that the commonality between them is an emphasis on autonomy and on empowering patients to be responsible for their own care. On this point, I have to say I am indebted to a wonderful Jewish bioethicist named Dr. Benjamin Friedman, Alav HaShalom, who unfortunately passed away at a relatively young age, but left an incredible volume. I think that was published posthumously, called Duty and Healing, where he develops the idea that autonomy is not a right within Judaism. It's not even a privilege. It is a duty that we may be stewards of our bodies, but to the extent that we are stewards, part of being responsible is being as proactive and as engaged as possible. And I think that idea, it runs through both of these articles, and if Jeff, you'll allow me to say, it's actually become somewhat of a running theme for my wife, Shana, and I together, and things that we've collaborated upon. Mm-hmm. The idea that patients are best situated to make decisions for themselves, including the decision, can they handle a frank discussion of prognosis? I think that's the cornerstone of the article about truth telling. My wife and I had the occasion to present and then publish an article for the Orthodox Forum called Balabai-Centered Halacha Consultation, the idea of taking the idea of patient-centered medicine, of engaging a patient, and bringing that over to the arena of asking halacha questions. My wife works professionally as a Yoetzet Halacha, fields halacha queries. We saw some of the same dynamics at play. She's actually has a forthcoming book also on empowering individuals to make decisions for themselves, to encourage them to trust their instincts in decision-making. And so too here also, I think the idea that patients know their situation best, they feel out the nuances, things that they may even find it difficult to describe to an outside party, to a rabbi, to someone else, what the degree of suffering is, what their degree of pessimism is of a particular treatment plan, and we can tell those patients, you know what's good for you. You have an instinct about this. You seem to know what's in your best interest. Halacha would endorse your following that. So I think that is the other common theme that runs through both of these works.
One of the interesting things that I learned, or an insight that I gained through the work that author and editor often do in bringing an essay to publication, was this kind of paradox at work in the field, that if many people would think that your position here is, could be classified, perhaps mistakenly so, but could be classified as a lenient position, because instead of medicine or halacha dictating to the patient, you must do everything that can be done in order to prolong life, we allow the dignity of the patient to dictate his autonomous decision-making and to say that he can choose what he wants, that if he knows down the road that he won't become tied to life prolonging devices, to respirators and to other things, that he'll have the choice, or his family will have the choice, to make a decision to remove him from a respirator, let's say, and the fear of some kind of ongoing vegetative state, which is, correctly so horrific to people, might not be the only outcome, and they can be released from that, it would allow people to undertake more procedures instead of saying, I'm not going to try that for fear of then getting to a position where I have lost control, I have lost autonomy. So what some might classify as a lenient position by giving more autonomy to the patient actually potentially has a greater utilitarian life-saving potential in the long run, because people will undertake procedures that they may have been wary of for fear of ever having gotten into that position. I'm not sure that I've expressed this as clearly as you do, but it was one of the very interesting insights that I took away from the piece.
Sure, I think it is a very insightful point. To be honest, it was not my own point. It was actually brought up in the rabbinic postscript. And so I'll attribute it to that. But the point itself, that giving people more latitude, letting them know that there is more, there's more openness down the road, they're not committing themselves to any particular path, may also leave them more open to trying something aggressive, almost experimenting. And knowing that the doors are still open, they haven't restricted themselves, I think is a very insightful point. I guess I would just add, again, for the sake of our listeners, that here the devil is in the details. Specifically, I draw attention to something that we already mentioned, that as far as this article and much other literature deals with withholding care and not withdrawing care, it does complicate this issue. The idea that we tell patients, let's give this a try and we'll see what happens. If it doesn't work, we'll reassess. Let's use an example. Patient is not breathing well and clearly is not going to be able to sustain the breathing on their own. We say we can attempt intubation, we can attempt ventilation. We hope that you're weaned. We hope that goes smoothly. And the event that you're not, and this becomes a harrowing affair, maybe we don't have to continue to pursue aggressive care. So that can encourage a patient to attempt that treatment. It would be facetious to say that we could simply to withdraw the ventilator down the line, because as we said, that most major post-com are not comfortable with that. The idea though, that other life-sustaining treatments don't have to be renewed, even if they're not interrupted, they don't have to be renewed. And in that way, at some point, nature would be allowed to take its course, is certainly something that's available. If I could add another point to that, as you said, sometimes we have a stringency that turns into a leniency and vice versa. Another example, I think, comes back to our earlier discussion about patients looking for certainty. Patients look for certainty. I've had the experience of Rabbanim looking for certainty as well. I've had the experience of being consulted on certain medical cases where the prognosis is poor, but the Rabbanim involved are working with a framework of only a patient who is terminal, who in Hebrew the term is a choleh hanoteh lamut, that's the only kind of patient who is authorized to decline care. And so someone might say to me, tell me, honestly, Dr. Goldberg, this patient, they really don't have any chance, right? And I'll say, I'm not sure. They have a poor chance. The odds are not good for them, but it would be premature for me to declare them to be irrecoverable. And so for all that, sometimes the desire to be very conservative and rigid in terms of our halachic framework, say we're only going to be mekil, we're only going to be lenient for patients who are clearly no telemut, but then we might, there might be there might be a leaning to try to prematurely define patients as being terminal and to try to push patients into that classification who don't belong.
Yeah. You mentioned a moment ago the halachic postscript, which is one of the, I think, really wonderful things we were able to do with this piece, something, you know, frankly, a little unusual for our journal, but we were delighted in light of the fact that we're publishing your proposal. You are, of course, a physician. You are, of course, a medical ethicist. You are, of course, a rabbi and teacher of Torah, but you're very quick to point out that you are not a posek that determines matters of Jewish law of the highest order. And the piece was reviewed by rabbis Herschel Schechter and Mordechai Willig of Yeshiva University in New York. And they penned a kind of a concurring opinion, a rabbinic postscript, which we publish alongside your piece. I should mention to our listeners that both of these articles are freely available, open access on our website, traditiononline.org. But tell us a little bit about what Rabbi Schechter and Willig write in their response.
Sure. I certainly think that their response is the most exciting piece of this whole project. I feel extraordinarily privileged to have them both. They were both quite gracious in reviewing multiple drafts of my full article, in lending their endorsements to its specific recommendations at the end, and then adding their own postscript. And I feel privileged to be a facilitator in bringing their rulings to the public eye. For one, they lend their endorsements to the recommendations in my article, and I obviously think those are important and practical for the public, not just for the public, for the public and the rabbis who serve them. In their own postscript, they add, I said, I was not mechadish anything, whereas Rav Schechter and Rav Willig do add what I think are important chidushim to the entire field of medical decision-making. Specifically, aside from the situations that I've talked about critical illness and medical uncertainty, they discuss patients who have little to no quality of life, patients with severe cognitive dysfunction, for example, advanced dementia, patients who are either unconscious or who have little to no awareness and little to no meaningful interaction with their surroundings. In those cases, Rav Schechter and Rav Willig take the position that there too, patients, not so much the patients, but merely the families that are serving as their surrogates, can make decisions in the best interest of the patient. And there's no absolute necessity to undergo medical treatments. If it seems in their judgment to be in the best interest of the patient to forgo medical treatments, then that would be legitimate. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, they say explicitly in this postscript that they decline to discriminate between different situations and kinds of medical treatments. In the past, other Poskim have distinguished between what they consider to be ordinary and extraordinary treatments, between things that are routine, such as hydration, feedings through a feeding tube, or even oxygen, and things that are more invasive, or even to distinguish between treatments that have become routine for a particular patient, let's say a patient who has for years been getting dialysis versus a new treatment which is being suggested. And here, Rav Willick and Rav Schechter, my understanding, say that a patient for whom the perpetuation of life does not seem to be worthwhile, a patient who either has such undue suffering or such little quality of life that, again, they do not discuss withdrawing care. There's actually a subtle footnote on that topic. When it comes to withholding care and care of any kind, Rav Schechter and Rav Willick, again, leave it in the hands of the people who know them best and have their best interests in mind.
It's the whole project, your piece and their response is incredibly empowering to people that find themselves in very difficult, critical circumstances. But I would say what you failed to, that Rabbis Schechter and Willig begin their essay by saying, Rabbi Dr. Judah Goldberg has written a masterful and important article based on the seminal rulings of Igret Moshe and others, and drawing on his extensive real-life experience in acute emergencies. Before we end, I'm, of course, mindful of the fact that we're having this conversation and that we published this essay in the middle of a worldwide pandemic, a pandemic which, of course, has placed many people on respirators. Of course, the pretext of what you write is not connected to COVID per se. The focus of the article is much more general and would be relevant even if we didn't find ourselves in the middle of this circumstance. Hopefully, I should say, we might hope that we're at the tail end of the pandemic, but who knows? So tell me a little bit about how your thinking on this, is filtered through the current medical moment that we find ourselves in.
It's a good question. As you said, I don't think there's any, no fundamental changes to the essential framework based on the pandemic or other circumstances. I do think there's a couple of points that this current pandemic highlights. One is the need for good decision-making. I think we've learned over time and it's evolved over time. But we've learned over time that for many, many patients, the full breadth of critical intervention and everything that modern technology can do is worthwhile. And we have to give patients every last chance, and we cannot give up on them. At the same time, I think the pandemic has only highlighted for us that I think it's our duty when I differentiate between when healthy people become sick and when sick people become sick. When people who are already very, very compromised develop a new critical illness, where we learn from experience that the prognosis is very, very poor, it behooves us to at least share good information and to empower patients and their families to be making good medical decisions. I think the role of doctors here, I should say, if we empower patients to be making their own decisions, then what happens to doctors? Do we minimize the role of doctors? I think quite to the contrary. Doctors become incredibly important facilitators. You need good information, you need good understanding, you need insight, and you need encouragement to make courageous decisions. And it's a courageous decision in either direction. If you let me digress here for one moment, Jeff, I can think vividly of situations where families have faced these kinds of decisions. Should the patient be intubated or not intubated? Should we undertake this or not? And we're standing there in the middle of the night in the emergency department, and I'm looking at family members with a pained look on their face, and they don't want to get this wrong. They don't want to let their loved one down in either direction. And something that I say to them, both to to concretize this, and in its own strange way to release them is, I want you to know something. I said, no matter what, 6 months from now, you're going to be sleepless about this decision. And you should know there's no way to escape that. There's no decision that's going to make you feel better. You can't say, well, be aggressive, and that way I'll release my conscience, or to the contrary, we'll make sure that they don't suffer in that way. Either way, your conscience is going to be plagued by the gravity of the decision. At the same time, that is unfortunately what life often thrusts upon us, is difficult decisions. Coming back to the topic about the pandemic, I think it has sharpened for us that it's our duty to be honest and straightforward and help people really understand what prognoses are, where treatment has a reasonable chance, and where it doesn't. I think a catchphrase that I've used sometimes is the difference between rationing care and providing rational care. We're not looking to withhold care to somehow save up on our supplies. Thank God the pandemic in most scenarios has not gotten to that point, even though it's a worthy discussion in its own right for another time. But how to provide rational care, how to help patients and families make their own rational decisions, certainly that's truer than ever. And the second point, which I don't think we can reflect upon this pandemic without mentioning, is if we talked about the theme of uncertainty, of working within a fog, not just the fog for a patient and the patient's particular prognosis, but for the medical establishment, we have all been so humbled. Patients and practitioners alike, collectively, we have been so humbled. And as you said, you offered an optimistic prediction that maybe we're at the tail end. And I would like to agree with you. And I say it so cautiously because we have been so humbled over and over by this capricious virus and by this unpredictable pandemic. On the one hand, it's humbling. On the other hand, still in the face of uncertainty, we have to find a path forward. And it's on the one hand, the doctor's role to help navigate the patients and their families through uncertainty, and the patient's role is to ultimately make the best decisions they have with the available information.
Well, in the piece you write, the best arbiters of suffering and its consequences may be the patients themselves, along with their caretakers, who can interpret ever-changing medical assessment in light of their deep, nuanced understanding of the overall situation and consider their options accordingly. The essay is A Halachic Framework for Decision-Making in Acute Critical Illness by Rabbi Dr. Judah Goldberg, with a rabbinic postscript by Rabbis Herschel Schechter and Mordechai Willig, appearing in the winter 2021 issue of Tradition, available open access online at traditiononline.org. I think that the proposals here have great potential to help people that are in very unfortunate, traumatic, and difficult circumstances to navigate their way through. So in that regard, we are in your debt, Judah Goldberg. Thank you for joining us on the Tradition Podcast.
Thank you very much for this opportunity. And thank you generally, Jeff, for all of the work on this project, and to the entire Tradition staff for bringing it to fruition.